Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. President Trump and Republicans aren't popular with younger voters. That's one of the takeaways from a nationwide poll conducted by Bucknell University's Institute for Public Policy. The poll found that 44% of Americans are less likely to support Republican candidates as the result of Trump's performance in office. With voters under the age of 35, 17% said they were more likely to vote for Republicans compared to 45% of voters over 55. Joining us is Dr. Chris Ellis, director of Bucknell University's Survey Research Laboratory and an associate professor of political science at Bucknell University. Dr. Ellis, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. I listed a few of the findings of the poll, but your takeaway, what are some of the major findings of this poll?
Yeah, I mean, I think what you hit it, that there's sort of a, we think of Donald Trump as polarizing and half the country loves him and half the country hates him. But sort of if you dig a little bit deeper, there's kind of a time bomb in here for Republicans among younger voters. That, Trump's popularity is certainly greater among people over 55, people over 65. But if we look at how Trump has made voters feel about other Republicans, that's what I think is sort of scary about for Republicans, because Trump will pass, right? But what we've seen is, particularly among voters under 35, there's this sense that Trump has soured them on the Republican Party entirely, right? And this is certainly the case among Democrats, of course, but particularly among independents, I think there's some numbers that are pretty scary for Republicans. So, for example, among people who call themselves political independents under 35, more than half say that Trump has made them less likely to vote for Republicans in the future, and less than 10% say he's made them more likely to vote for Republicans in the future. So that's a, after Trump is gone even, that is a problem that Republicans are going to have to contend with going forward.
Do you know why? Did any of those who were polled give any suggestions or any reasons why?
Well, there's some sense that it's sort of the coarseness of the language and some of the other stuff. One of the things that we found, though, is that young voters are particularly sour on Trump's use of social media, which, I think is kind of interesting because this is the social media savvy generation, of course, and all these sort of things. But even young Republicans sort of are kind of cool on Trump's use of Twitter and whether it makes them feel good about the job he's doing and things like that. And so, a lot of the stuff about Trump does sort of break down in partisan lines, but I think it's sort of the extra presidential things he does, particularly social media, that seems to make young people cringe a little bit.
And just to point out, this poll was conducted nationwide before the government shutdown, correct?
That is correct, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the questions on the poll center around whether voters are more or less likely to vote for Republican candidates as a result of President Trump's term in office. So who should be most concerned if you look at the poll? It would seem to be Republican candidates.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something of that. And Republicans have had to do this kind of weird song and dance for a couple of years where you can't abandon your own party's president, and he's certainly doing some things like nominating judges that do sort of fit with what the party wants, but also sort of, being worried, being cognizant about what Trump's reputation is for the long-term health of the Republican Party. And so, yeah, they've had to sort of walk this line for quite some time, and it certainly looks, at least from our data, that it's for better or worse, the Republican Party is Donald Trump's party now. And it seems like young voters are not particularly enamored with that.
So when we talk about candidates, Republican candidates being concerned, candidates for what? Federal offices, state offices, Republicans in general, or what?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's everybody. I mean, particularly we ask about federal offices mostly. So, Republican congressional candidates and things like that. But certainly there's, some sense that the Republican brand has become Trump's brand, in ways that maybe it wasn't even George W. Bush's brand or Ronald Reagan's brand, but Trump has sort of, become the face of the party in some sort of very specific ways. And, if that's the case, then the label becomes Trump. It doesn't matter whether you're running for Senate or local dog catcher. There's that association that voters see.
Now, the age differences in this poll are what is most startling. As you mentioned, 17% of voters under the age of 35 say they're more likely to vote for Republicans as a result of Trump's time in office compared to 45% of those 55 and over. I don't know. If I was a Republican candidate or maybe even President Trump, I'd think, well, that's not a necessarily bad thing because people 55 and older, older voters, turn out in much larger percentages at the polls than do those 35 and under.
Well, that is absolutely true. And in the short term, you know, this, you know, you might not see the effects of this. I mean, the midterms were what they were, but there are other factors that, I think contributed to that. But yeah, in the short term, Trump still remains popular among the people that vote the most. And so that's, you know, that's something that Republicans, I think, can take solace in, that, you know, among the people that are going to be affecting the election in 2020, 2022, those people are still largely in Trump's camp, not exclusively, but sort of much more supportive than the rest of the population. The thing that, might concern Republicans more, though, is what people do politically when they're under, particularly when they're under 30, sticks with them as they're they get older, right? We see generational effects of some generations being more Republican than, others, some being more Democratic than others. And a lot of this behavior is sort of fixed when people are young. And so to the extent that they're being socialized into a Trump Republican Party now, that's going to carry through long after Trump is off the political stage. So that would be sort of the long-term concern. But you're correct, right? I mean, you know, young people don't vote very much. Even in the midterms, they didn't, you know, this was the year of the young voter, but they didn't vote anywhere near the rates that, senior citizens did. So Republicans can take solace in that.
Why is it, though, and again, I don't know whether you can answer this question or not, but there's some inferences and some takeaways here. I ask about why President Trump wasn't popular amongst younger voters. What about those older voters? I mean, 45%, and remember, this is Republican, Democrats, and independents, 45%. That's almost half of those who were polled say they were more likely to vote for Republicans. So, you know, why that difference in how the age groups view the president and Republican candidates?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, part of it is sort of Trump appeals to, that particular cultural element. I think part of it is Trump is willing to fight, right? That he is, you know, that particularly among older Republicans, but I think among, you know, Republicans in general and people who have conservative values in general, there's been a sense that Republicans have sort of abandoned the culture wars, that they sort of just slowly admit defeat and don't really fight these wars in ways that maybe they'd like. And Trump, you know, for all of his, you know, for maybe being uncouth in the way he does it, and maybe, but he's willing to fight over, you know, he's willing to fight battles over the national anthem. He's willing to fight battles over illegal immigration and these things. And I think that's appealing, right, to finally find someone who, you know, regardless of what he believes personally, is willing to go to the mat for these sorts of things. And I think that is appealing to lots of voters, particularly voters who feel like they've been kind of abandoned on these issues for quite some time.
We're speaking with Dr. Chris Ellis, director of Bucknell University Survey Research Laboratory and an associate professor of political science at Bucknell, talking about a poll conducted, a nationwide poll on whether voters are more or less likely to vote for President, or I should say Republicans, as a result of President Trump's term in office. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@WITF.org. You can leave a question or comment on Twitter. We're at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Right, as I said, you know, this is broken down. It is a nationwide poll. Let me ask the breakdown of who was polled across the country.
So it was basically just a random sample of the American population. So hopefully we got, you know, as many women, as many men, as many older voters, as many younger voters, as many Republicans, as many Democrats as there are in the country at large. So hopefully, you know, we pay money to sort of make sure that this is as representative of the country as we can get.
Mm-hmm. How many people were polled?
We had 1,000. So we have, you know, a margin of error on this of about 3%. So the numbers aren't, you know, 100% accurate, but they should tell us, you know, the story sticks, right? The story tells us what I think the actual story is.
Mm-hmm. So breaking it down even more amongst young Democrats, young independents, young Republicans, what's it look like when you break it down into those age groups, and or I should say parties?
Yeah, so Democrats, I mean, and this is not a surprise, regardless of age, are universally negative about Trump. It doesn't matter whether they're young or old, that you know, they've basically, you know, have given up on anything he can do and are universally negative. Among Republicans and independents, there's sort of a more interesting story. That's where we see the age splits, right? That younger Republicans are still basically supportive of Trump, but still we only find about a third of them saying that Trump makes them think more positively about the Republican Party, which again compares to about 60% of people who are over the age of 55. So young Republicans are not anti-Trump by any stretch of the imagination, but certainly not as excited about him as maybe some older Republicans are. And independents the same way, right? And these are the numbers I think would concern Republican candidates for office going forward, is that independent voters, particularly young independent voters, are really sour on what Trump has done, not just Trump personally, but what he's made them think about the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm. What about gender, women and men? We know that there are many other polls that have shown that the president doesn't do very well with women.
Right. And, I think that's largely true. But again, that's sort of a phenomenon just among independents that, you know, among Democrats, again, it doesn't matter who you are. You hate Trump and you hate the Republican Party because of him. Among Republicans, Trump actually still does pretty well among women, not quite as well as he does among men, particularly white men. But he still does reasonably well among female voters in terms of how they view him as a person, how they view him as a policymaker, and things like that. But it's sort of independent women, particularly younger independent women, where Trump sees a lot of trouble, right? That this is, you know, if there's one group that maybe Republicans are losing for a long time because of the Trump presidency, it might be independent women who might sort of be, or younger independent women, who might sort of be open to the idea of a Republican on fiscal grounds or on security grounds and things like that, but just don't like him for whatever reason. And I think that's the group that is probably the biggest red alarm for Republicans going forward.
Well, yeah, looking at the results of the poll, women under the age of 35 more supportive of the Republican Party, only 8%. Less supportive of the Republican Party for women under 35, 63%. All women more supportive of the Republican Party, 25%, less supportive, 50%, and there's like 25% neither more or less. I guess you could call those the undecideds if we were looking at an election at this point.
Yes, or the people smart enough not to be paying attention to all of this.
Yeah. All right, let's take a call from Jim in Enola. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, you're welcome.
This is very interesting information, and it kind of reflects what people would tend to think intuitively. I think Democrats don't want to get too fat and happy about this news, though, because there's two realities. One reality is you can't beat somebody with nobody, and you know the Democrats are going to have to nominate a viable candidate. Secondly, the Democrats, it's important for the Democrats to nominate someone who can appeal to independents, that appeals to all Democrats and independents. And there are some candidates out there that I would characterize on the Democratic side that I would characterize as fringe candidate. The issue with Trump is, yeah, he has a ceiling, but his floor is about the same as his ceiling. He's got a core of maybe 35% to 40%. And if the Democrats nominate a divisive candidate, Trump's likely to get reelected because, like I said, his ceiling is his floor. And there's 40% or so of people out there who will vote for Trump, and he'll get reelected. So thank you.
Hey, Jim, thank you very much for your call. What do you think, Dr. Wells?
Yeah, that's a good point, right? That, you know, Trump is unpopular in a vacuum. People don't like him. But, you know, once he's – we saw this in 2016. Once he's matched against another human being, then all of a sudden maybe he seems a little bit more popular. So Hillary Clinton, I think, was a moderate in various ways, but sort of unlikable in other ways. But I think the fear for the Democrats now is that they overplay their hand, right? They get too cocky and they nominate someone who's way too far left or believes all sorts of things that are way too far left. And all of a sudden, Trump doesn't sound as, you still might not like him, but, you know, Trump won in 2016 on the backs of people who didn't like him but held their nose and voted for him anyway because the alternative was worse. And if Democrats do that again, then, you know, it certainly wouldn't be surprising to see the same result again.
And this poll really doesn't ask anything about Democratic candidates.
It does not, right?
It does not.
And so, you know, again, we see, you know, Trump won about, maybe not have the exact number right, but Trump won about 25% of voters in 2016 who thought he was unfit to serve as president. And so, you know, it's one thing to say you don't like Trump. It's another thing to say, well, look at the alternative. Maybe he's not so bad after all. So, you know, I think there is something to say about Trump maybe doing long-term damage to the Republican Party, particularly as younger voters are sort of socialized with his presidency. But absolutely, right, if Democrats sort of overplay their hand here and decide that, you know, you know, think that they have an opportunity to just nominate whoever they want and win, I think that would be very much a rude awakening.
The president has his State of the Union address tonight. One speech probably doesn't change a lot of minds. And let's face it, really, in a lot of ways, I think there are probably many people who are loath to think about 2020 already here in February 2019. But is there something or what could the president say during his State of the Union address tonight that would make younger voters find him more appealing?
Well, I mean, I think the first point you made is the right one, that State of the Unions really don't move the needle too much. There's two ways he can go, right? One is the sort of conciliatory route where he, you know, reads off the teleprompter, you know, and says nice things about bringing the country together. And I think, you know, there might be some value in that, in trying to, you know, appeal to younger voters by saying he's sort of, you know, he's willing to compromise, he's willing to be moderate, he's willing to sort of, you know, bend ideological commitments. I think, you know, younger voters might like that. But the other way he can go, and, you know, I'm guessing the way he's actually going to go, is sort of what your caller said, right? That, you know, we have 40% of the country that likes him. We need to make sure that those people show up and vote. And so he can talk a lot about, you know, illegal immigration. There's some, you know, at least some sources have said he's going to go hard into abortion policy and pro-life stuff. And so if he does that, you know, that might not be great for younger voters, but it would, you know, make sure that 35-40% of the country that really does like him is energized again. And so we've seen that happen every so often whenever a Supreme Court justice is nominated, that people who are sort of, you know, in Trump's camp kind of weakly become happy again. And he might use, I think he very well might use the speech to just do that, right, to appeal to these people and make sure that they know that, you know, they can still count on him.
Mm. Let's take a phone call from Sherry in Lewisburg. Sherry, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. I had a quick comment, but then most importantly, a question. Those people who show up as not having their minds changed at all by Trump, they might not necessarily not be paying attention. They might be people who already had very strongly held feelings, positively or negatively, and President Trump simply confirmed them. And that's why you don't see any movement there. But my question is, as young people get older, they do tend to get more conservative in their voting patterns. So, Professor Ellis, do you see that as a possible outcome, even though now the negatives are pretty high among young people? Do you think they might move to become more positively as they get older?
Hmm. Hey, Sherry, thank you very for your question, and that is a very good question. Dr. Ellis, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there is some truth to that, right? Particularly on, not so much on social issues, where people sort of what they believe when they're 30 is sort of what they believe going forward. But certainly on economic stuff, right, that as young people get older, they get homes, they worry about the quality of public schools, there is, you know, some move to, at least some modest move to the right based on that. And so, you know, it's certainly not unreasonable at all to think that younger voters might be, you know, more amenable to a Republican tax plan or more amenable to a Republican, you know, education plan or something like that as they get older, because that's just sort of a natural part of what happens. The thing that Republicans should be, you know, I think worried about is that, you know, if what happens is voters aren't voting on that anymore, but they're sort of voting on cultural stuff, I think that's where Republicans now could lose younger voters for a while. And, you know, not to say that they won't, you know, they're not going to sort of follow the Democratic Party or the sort of radical left wing of the Democratic Party down the road to socialism. I don't think anything like that is going to happen because, again, they do get more conservative as they get older. But, you know, if they grow up seeing the Republican Party as Trump's party and they don't like him, I mean, you know, what happens when you're young sticks, right? There's a lot of evidence that suggests that sort of basic views of right and wrong don't change that much. Some policy positions change that much, but basic views of right and wrong don't change that much. And so, you know, if they view the Republican Party as being Trump's baby, then that could potentially be damaging. Not, you know, again, not to say that they won't move to the right or they can't move to the right, but it would be harder if this is the environment in which they grew up.
The backdrop of and context of Sherry's question is a good one, though, too, in that amongst polls that we see, that America's young people especially on cultural issues, on social issues, are tilting more to the left. And, I think many people have asked just the question that Sherry did, when they get older, will they become more conservative? But would you agree? I mean, you see students all the time. Do they lean more liberal today than maybe what they even used to?
Oh, absolutely they do. And you know, again, the students I see are not a random sample of America's population, but you certainly see that. I don't think they're, except for a loud minority, I don't think they're particularly vocal about it. I don't think it's quite the crisis situation that some people have portrayed that it is. But there is this idea among younger people, and this is not new, but there is this idea among younger people of, issues of welcoming undocumented immigrants. Like, why are we having this debate anymore, right? Or issues of, things like, same-sex marriage. Like, why are we having this debate? And, I think Republicans have moderated their rhetoric, at least on some of those issues, but we're certainly seeing that move. The one exception that I think is kind of interesting is probably abortion, where, we've seen people move to the left on things like marijuana and drug legalization and same-sex marriage and diversity and all sorts of other things. But abortion is an issue where opinions haven't changed that much across generations. And, to the extent that is a cultural issue that matters, I think, maybe there's some opportunity for Republicans there. But, yeah, in general, I think, younger people are just sort of more culturally, laissez-faire, I guess, than previous generations.
One final question. When you read about, and of course, we're reading a lot of stories tonight about anticipating what President Trump is going to say in the State of Union. But along with that, often you hear about his poll numbers. These poll numbers, you have the word trouble in the headline that would signal some trouble for the president and Republican candidates. What is unusual about this is that the economy is doing so well under normal circumstances. Of course, nothing has been normal during the Trump administration, but under normal circumstances with an economy like this, the president usually has numbers in the positive above 50% at least, probably even higher than that. So this would seem to come down to Trump's personality and how he is in public and factors other than the economy.
That's a really good point. So, two things about Trump's approval rating. One is they don't move at all. They've been more stable than any president that we've had since we started asking this question. And part of that is, not just about Trump. It's the country polarizing in ways. But Trump has been basically between 40 and 46%. Throughout his entire presidency. And if we look back at other presidents, George W. Bush was as high as 90% post 9/11 and as low as like 15 post financial crisis. And Trump just doesn't have any of that movement built in. But the second part, you're right. The economy is really good. By at least recent historical standards, we're not sort of embroiled in any major foreign conflict. We're always fighting here and there. And so those are usually the things that make presidents really popular because people like results, right? Do I feel richer? And I think, there's questions about distribution, but most Americans say in polls that they do. And, we're not worried about sort of real massive things on the global stage right now, at least the urgent things. So these are the kinds of things that make presidents popular. And so Trump has not received the benefit of those things in ways that other presidents, maybe a President Rubio might or something like that. The question is what happens when the invariable, the recession comes, which it will come at some point. Then what happens to Trump? And I think, maybe the fact that he has this floor will sort of insulate him on the downside, too, that he won't be punished. Just as he wasn't rewarded for a good economy, he won't be punished for a bad one in the same way as other presidents might, because our feelings of him are just sort of so strongly baked into the cake.
I said that was the last question, but we have an email question from a listener who asked, this poll was taken before the government shutdown. How do you think the numbers would change if the poll were taken today after the record-breaking shutdown and another one on the horizon?
Yeah, well, we're going to do this again, aren't we? there is some evidence from other polls that Trump has become a little bit less popular post-government shutdown because most people blamed it on him and the Republicans. I don't know if that's going to last because, now it's in the rearview mirror and we have kind of a short memory as a country, so I'm not sure that's going to last. He probably is a little bit less popular now than when this was taken, but I don't think it would be by very much, simply because, again, you know, you look at him first and foremost, and everything else is almost secondary.
Mm. Dr. Chris Ellis is director of Bucknell University's Survey Research Laboratory and an associate professor of political science at Bucknell. Dr. Ellis, thank you very much with the information.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, we have an analysis of Governor Tom Wolf's budget proposals. So that's coming up on tomorrow's show. Last year, Pennsylvania's legislature passed Marcy's Law, an effort to give crime victims or their families constitutional rights on the level that criminal defendants get. Because it would require a change in Pennsylvania's constitution, Marcy's Law must pass both the House and Senate this year and be put to a referendum for voters to consider. It would have to be approved by voters to become a constitutional amendment. Joining us on today's program is Democratic Senator John Sabatina of Philadelphia. Senator Sabatina, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me. Good morning.
Also joining us is Pennsylvania's victim advocate Jennifer Storm. Jennifer Storm, good to see you again.
Good morning.
And Jen Riley, the state director of Marcy's Law for Pennsylvania. Ms. Riley, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Senator Sabatina, let me talk to you first about the passage of this in the legislature. As I said, for a constitutional amendment, had to pass two consecutive terms of the House and Senate, the legislature, and then go to voters. So we start again year two for Marcy's Law. Talk about it, why you support it.
Well, I support it because it's basically the right thing to do. It equates... It equates criminal victims and the people that accost them the same rights, the same constitutional rights, the right to be known, right to have a notice. Excuse me, hold on a minute, please.
Sorry. It's okay. We have a cough button here, but
yeah. Yeah, I'm fighting a cold. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. I hope you feel better.
Yeah. Basically, it allows criminal victims to receive information about their rights, receive information about the trial, receive information about any plea bargain, receive any information about the incident and things that are important to the case in general.
Mm. So, Jen Riley, you are the state director of Marcy's Law for Pennsylvania. You know, it's kind of unusual, I think, that we have a state director for legislation that hasn't been passed yet. So, tell me what your role as state director is.
Yeah, sure. So, Marcy's Law is a national effort.
It is.
We're going state by state in order to elevate these rights to a constitutional level to provide equality for victims of crime. And so, really, this issue has to go through two legislative sessions. So we've already passed last session. We're starting up again this session. But then the real key thing is that we have to go to the voters. And so we're hoping that we pass this session soon. And then this November, voters in Pennsylvania will have an opportunity to decide whether or not we value crime victims' rights enough to elevate those rights to our state constitution.
So that's your goal, to have it on the ballot by November.
That's right.
Okay. And, you know, 2019 is not exactly a year where there will be a huge voter turnout. I hate to think about the politics of this, but that's the reality, is that we don't have any statewide races or anything like that to really draw voters. Good or bad thing?
Well, it really just depends. So in an off year like this, we're probably expecting about 26% of the voters to come out to the polls. You know, but we have to look at this economically, too. You know, we are going to have a major push to make sure that every voter in Pennsylvania is aware of Marcy's Law. And to go in a presidential election year, that's going to be really expensive. And so we're going to try for 2019. But, you know, we could push it to 2020 if we had to. Let's say we didn't move through the session that quickly this year. But it's going to be the difference of millions of dollars.
Mm-hmm. As you said, this is a state-by-state thing. How many states have approved Marcy's Law so far? It's starting in California. Maybe provide a little bit of background as to why it is named Marcy's Law, but it started in California after a 1983 murder.
It did. So Marcy Nicholas was a college student in 1983, and she was stalked and murdered by an ex-boyfriend. And a week after her death, Marcy's brother and mother visited her grave and went to the grocery store, a normal everyday activity. And they ran face to face with the accused murderer in the grocery store. They had not been notified that he had been released on bail. And it was at that moment that Marcy's brother, Dr. Henry Nicholas, decided that he would do everything in his power to make sure that nobody else had to endure, one, the trauma of just having his sister murdered, but then running into the accused in a grocery store without notification. And so Dr. Nicholas just happens to be a billionaire, and he has made it his life's mission to go state by state and elevate crime victims' rights. And we're really fortunate to have a funder like that and somebody to have that drive and money, quite frankly, to do this. But Marcy's Law has passed in 11 states so far. And actually, a handful of states last November. And we're currently active in 6 states right now. So we are just marching toward D.C. And we just, you know, the march to D.C. goes straight through Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
So just to make sure that everyone is aware, you're talking U.S. Constitution as opposed to just Pennsylvania Constitution.
So the ultimate goal, Dr. Nicholas's vision, is to amend the U.S. Constitution. But the easiest pathway to do that is to amend state by state. And so Pennsylvania is currently one of only 9 states that doesn't have constitutional protections for crime victims. And so, like I said, we're active in a handful of other states currently, and soon we will turn our efforts to D.C. in a few years. But right now, we have to focus on the Pennsylvania Constitution.
So, Jennifer Storm, maybe we should lay out, well, I know we should, lay out for our listeners what exactly Marcy's Law would do.
So when crime victims kind of started to pass rights, right, when we started to look at victims' rights in the 90s, a lot of states went the route of constitutional rights. So as Jen said, while Marcy's Law is only in 11 states currently active, we're only one of 9 states that don't address victims' rights in our Constitution. We chose to go the statutory route, which is fine. We have very strong, robust rights for victims. They have the right to be informed. They have the right to be heard. They have the right to be notified. They have the right to be present. They have the right to be financially restored to the extent possible. So there's all of these great rights. And over the years, we've added rights, right? We now, victims can come before the parole board and speak to the parole board in person. So we've always added rights. The problem is we have rights without remedies. So one of the things my office does as the Office of Victim Advocate is we run what we call the compliance department. So for years as a state, we have been looking at the issue of violation of victims' rights. What does a victim do if they're not informed? What do they do if they're not heard in the court proceeding? What do they do if something goes forward and they're not present and all of their rights are forfeited? And unfortunately, the answer is there's nothing they can do. They can file a formal complaint with my office. We investigate it to the best of our ability, which just means we're going to call the entities that the person is saying violated their rights. We're going to try to figure out what happened, and then we're going to educate that county, whether it's the prosecutor, the victim service unit, juvenile probation officer, the judge in some cases. But at the end of the day, if the case has already moved through the system and it's disposed of, right? So let's say the guy's been sentenced or it's in the juvenile system and there's been a disposition, we can't go back and do anything for that survivor. So the challenge becomes, do you really have rights if you can't enforce them? And I would contend that you really don't. You only have rights if you know that you have the right, and if the entities charged with ensuring those rights happen are doing what they're supposed to be doing. Now, we have a great state. I'm very proud to represent the state of Pennsylvania. We are phenomenal when it comes to victims, whether it's their rights, passing legislation that's important and that is meaningful. Where we fail is that when the system fails a victim, which happens, whether it's because of the expeditious nature of the system or just because it's quick, right? Sometimes you'll
be
in court.
Give me an example.
So miscellaneous court.
Okay. I mean, we don't want to violate anyone's privacy.
Sure. So I'm going to give you a real everyday scenario.
Okay.
If you walk into any county courthouse in the Commonwealth, most of them kind of schedule their days in chunks. So there's this one day called miscellaneous court day. And that's really where anything kind of gets thrown on the docket and cases are disposed of really quick, right? Disposed of really quickly. So you could have a person coming before the judge on a let's just say a drug crime, right? And then all of a sudden, the prosecutor or the defense attorney pulls out, oh, he has a rape charge too. What they'll sometimes do is say they'll negotiate those charges, right? Or because they have the person present in court, they'll say, well, we've got him here for this, but we've also got this pending issue.
They're trying to save time.
Yeah, but they're trying to save time, which makes sense. That's a good thing for the taxpayers. But what'll happen then is they quickly resolve a case that involves a crime victim, and they'll do so without notifying the crime victim of the court date, without giving the victim the right to be present, without giving the victim the right to be heard to the court, and then sometimes without the victim's right to put forth restitution requests. So you've violated like four or five of the crime victim's rights in the interest of just trying to get a case through the system quickly. So what happens is we're having to go back, and I worked at the local level for 10 and a half years, so I used to have to make these calls all the time. Call the victim, I'm so very sorry, this case was disposed of quickly this morning, the guy was sentenced, he's going off to prison, I'm very sorry. And we often end up apologizing for the system, and that's not the way it's supposed to work. And I truly do not believe that that is what the authors of our Crime Victims Act meant in the 90s, and it's certainly not what we as a state want to put forth to survivors. If we value their involvement in the system enough, then we need to enforce their rights and give them remedies.
Senator Sabatino, you know, I think that if you ask, and we'll find out if there's a referendum, but if you ask the people of this state if they would like to expand crime victims' rights or make sure that crime victims are a priority, they probably would say yes. But, now here's a but. American Civil Liberties Union here in Pennsylvania, and I think across the country, has come out against this because they say, well, I think the big complaint is they don't want to make it a constitutional amendment. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, obviously I'm not in agreement with the ACLU on this issue, but I believe for the reasons Jen already stated, it needs to be a constitutional issue. There was a case in Philadelphia. I was an assistant district attorney for 5 years in Philadelphia, and we were always taught that, you know, we had to involve the victim in the disposition of the crime, and I always tried to do that. However, if I failed to do that, there's no repercussions. There's a case in point. There's a gentleman was shot by a robber using an AK-47 in Philadelphia earlier last year, and a plea was offered to him for 3.5 to 10 years. For shooting someone, basically a point blank rage, and the victim wasn't contacted. He wasn't notified. He wasn't asked. Nothing was checked on as to his condition, and they went before the judge. They tried to bring the case back before the judge to renegotiate the plea, and the judge basically said a deal's a deal, and the defendant got away with 3 to 10 years. So I think it's necessary to elevate it to a constitutional level just so the victim has some recourse.
Let me, as a former prosecutor, what should that robber, that shooter, have gotten? 3 to 10 years, I mean, I'm assuming that the victim did not die, that the victim survived. What would have been an appropriate sentence in your opinion?
Well, the victim did not die, but he does suffer some major health issues as a result of the shooting. You know, a lot of it depends on the defendant's prior record. A lot of it depends on the egregiousness of the crime itself. So it's hard for me to say he should have got a blank number, you know, a certain number. A lot of it goes into the callousness of the crime and things like that. So I'm hesitant to say he should have got 10 to 20, but I think the point is that the victim was not consulted in this.
That was my follow-up to that.
But. Yeah.
All right, we're going to talk more about Marcy's Law for Pennsylvania in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest today, Jen Riley, State Director, Marcy's Law for Pennsylvania, Pennsylvania's victim advocate, Jennifer Storm, Democratic Senator John Sabatino of Philadelphia. We're talking about Marcy's Law for Pennsylvania. It passed the Pennsylvania legislature last year. It must pass again this year, both House and Senate, and then it would go to a referendum for voters to decide. Would give some constitutional rights to crime victims, as many have said, maybe some of the on the level of those that defendants have on a constitutional level. 1-800-729-7532 is our phone number if you would like to send a question or comment via Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. I want to follow up Jennifer Storm. We were talking with Senator Sabatino about the ACLU's complaint that they thought that you know that this should not rise to the constitutional level because every case is different. I'm not going to answer for them, but your thoughts on that?
So I think first and foremost, we don't amend our constitution lightly, right? So I think in Pennsylvania we have a constitution that is there to really reflect the values of the Commonwealth. And if we value the involvement of the crime victim, and we value the impact of an accusation enough on an accused that we make sure that they have certain rights, inalienable rights in our Constitution, but we don't do that same thing for those that are harmed. And I want to make it really clear, the only thing we're trying to put in the Constitution is existing statutory rights and or common practice in our county courthouses every day. So we're not trying to give victims anything different than they have today, with the exception of the ability to enforce those rights. So in the case that, that Senator Sabatino referenced in Philadelphia, I don't know that the victim's impact statement, which was one of the things denied, right? So that victim in that case was denied the right to be informed of a sentencing hearing, the right to confer with the prosecutor on a guilty plea. So they have the right to confer. What does that mean? They don't have the right to say, this is the sentence I want, and then the prosecutor goes forward with marching orders. They don't have what we call as a victim veto. They have the right to confer. So the prosecutor says, this is the deal on the table. You know, we think it's reasonable, we think it's not reasonable, but we would like your input. The survivor, the family members, or the directly impacted victim can say, yeah, I think that's reasonable, or no, I'm not comfortable with that. At the end of the day, the prosecutor says what deal goes, right, in conjunction with the defense counsel. So, but they have that right to confer, right? So it's that meaningful involvement so that the victim's not just looked upon as a piece of evidence in the system, but somebody integral to the case who was really egregiously harmed. So they have that right to be informed, that right to confer. And then there was a sentencing hearing held, and that victim wasn't notified of the hearing. They weren't present. At the sentencing hearing is the only time the victim actually has an actual voice in the system. So that's when they can say, this is the psychological...
You're talking about the victim in Philadelphia.
The victim in Philly,
was
yeah.
not at the sentencing
yes.
hearing.
Or
okay.
any other victim in the Commonwealth. If okay. there is a juvenile disposition or a sentencing, the victim has the right to be present and heard. And it's probably the most important right for a victim because it's when they get to talk about the psychological, emotional, physical reality that this act of violence had on them. It's also when they get to put restitution on the docket so that the offender can then pay that restitution. It's not a weighted factor for the judge, so the judge can hear the impact and then obviously has to look at the sentence that's appropriate for that person. And as the senator indicated, there's a pre-sentencing investigation that happens. There's sentencing guidelines that we have in Pennsylvania. A victim's impact statement is not going to impact the sentence to a degree that the judge is going to come back and probably change the sentence. But it gives them the ability to be heard, and it gives them the ability to put their restitution on the record. And that's important, and we should value that in Pennsylvania. And I say we should value it enough to put it in our Constitution.
Let's take a phone call from Devin in York. Devin, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi there, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, you're welcome.
My home state of North Dakota is one of the few instances where I've seen Marcy's Law being cited by law enforcement. And you know, really, the net effect that I've seen is that if there's ever a question of, say, like, excessive use of force or anything like that, that a lot of times they'll use that, citing Marcy's Law, to shield that information on behalf of, you know, police officers involved. And while I certainly agree with the benefits of Marcy's Law and that constitutional protection should be afforded to all citizens, both, you know, citizens and civil servants, I am curious about the impact of, you know, transparency from our policing organizations. And, you know, while I can't cite the specific instances, they aren't particularly high profile. I am curious if your speakers are familiar with those instances or other similar instances in states that have Marcy's Law in their state constitutions and, you know, whether that's a concern for people when we expect our institutions to be transparent and held, you know, be able to be accountable for actions if the net effect is to, you know, have less transparency overall.
Hey, Devin, thank you very much for your call. And I will follow up with what Devin said. He said he couldn't think of a particular high-profile incident I can. There was just recently where the five bank employees were murdered. That, you know, most of the attention came back because it didn't get much attention in the national media with so many other things going on. But that the police chief who released that information did not release the names of the victims and cited Murphy's Law. And there were people coming out and saying, okay, what about transparency? So following up on Devin's question, what about that, Jen?
Yeah, so the difference with the Pennsylvania and the North Dakota Murphy's Law, so there is model language for Murphy's Law, but each state, you know, it's incumbent upon each state to tailor that model language to make it applicable and for the state that's passing the law. North Dakota and Florida, in their Murphy's Law language, had a specific provision for privacy that's not included in the Pennsylvania law. So basically what the Pennsylvania Murphy's Law is doing, it's referring the privacy back to the General Assembly and back to the police departments and the law enforcement in order to handle those privacy issues. I will say in the Florida case that you just mentioned,
the horrible bank
shooting where five women were shot, that in essence, the law enforcement went to all of the victims' families and said, you know, are you comfortable with us releasing your names? Some families were, and those names were released. One or at least two families weren't. And I would argue that the release of the names doesn't inherently affect the details of the case and making people aware of dangers in the community. That was a choice by that family, and I would contend that's an appropriate choice for a victim's family to make.
Agreed.
Senator Sabatino, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I tend to agree. In the current legislation, there is no privacy aspect to it where a person's name can be shielded. However, I agree with Jen that, you know, in the grand scheme of things, the relevancy of the victims' names is really it's not really pertinent at, you know, whether or not someone knows the victims' names or not. It's not pertinent to whether or not they get a fair trial or things like that. So
I don't know if it would be fair trial as much as transparency and the public's right to know. You see, Jen Storm, I see you kind of...
I know, because I don't know that the public has the right to know.
I know what you're saying. I know what you're saying.
The victim's name. I don't know where the benefit comes.
And I'm not arguing one way or the other.
And
I'm just saying.
Yeah, it's why we have a rape shield law, right? We don't publish the names of rape victims because it's not in the public's interest to know that Jane Doe was raped. Why, you know, what transparency, what security benefit, what public safety benefit does that offer? It's more about we're in this salacious time where people just want to know every single detail. But again, getting back to what Jen Riley said, it's not in our provision. So Murphy's Law is, the beauty of Murphy's Law is that it really tailors itself to the state. And we're only elevating that which is already existing rights for crime victims. We're not trying to give victims any other rights other than the right to enforce their rights. So we really were trying to be protective and wanted to make sure that we could say that and know that it's true. So privacy was not something we put in our Crime Victims Act in the 90s, and it's not something we're trying to put into it today with Murphy's Law.
You know, we only have a minute left, and I don't know if you can answer this question, but if you're looking for an amendment to the U.S. Constitution, wouldn't all the laws have to be uniform?
Well, basically the spirit of the laws would be uniform, and then it needs to pass both chambers.
But the Constitution doesn't count spirit.
Well, it doesn't, but then each state would have to ratify it.
I understand.
So,
All right, we only have a minute left. And Senator Sabatino is an attorney. I probably could talk to you about that, but we'll leave that for another show. Jen Riley, you had mentioned to me that there are polls out there, public polls in Pennsylvania, about whether Murphy's Law is supported or not.
We just actually earlier in January conducted a statewide poll where when we educated and informed voters whether or not, you know, they would vote if the election was held today, would you vote for Murphy's Law? 87% of Pennsylvania voters said that they would vote on Murphy's Law today in the positive. And that crossed every, you know, demographic, every corner of the state, every political affiliation. I mean, all voters agree. And that's really comforting to me, and I'm sure to Jennifer Storm, that Pennsylvania voters value crime victims' rights enough.
I want to thank you very much for being with us today. We'll keep our eyes on this as we go through the legislative session this year. Democratic Senator John Sabatini of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania victim advocate Jennifer Storm, Jen Riley, State Director of Marcy's Law for Pennsylvania. Thank you all for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, we analyze Governor Wolf's budget proposal he's making today.